This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Cachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Cachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Very excited about today's show. It's going to be wonderful. We have talking to us Omali Ishatela, chairman of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party. He founded the Burning Spear newspaper in 1968, which still exists. He's been a longtime advocate for reparations and participated in the International Tribunal on Reparations for African People, which was held in Brooklyn, New York in 1982. And he founded the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement in 1991. So excited to be talking to him. So without further ado, let's just bring him onto the virtual stage. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. You?
Uhuru.
Uhuru. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Can you just start out telling us what happened to you and your offices July 29th?
At 5 o'clock in the morning here, Central Time, I'm in St. Louis right now, a loud racket out in front of my house that included this voice on a loudspeaker commanding me and everybody who was in the house to come out with our hands raised and empty. And then flashbang grenades began to explode all around the house. And I was to learn later that it actually penetrated the rear stairwell of the house and had thrown flashbang grenades there as well. And so I asked my wife to let me go out first and that she should try and call. And let people know that we were being raided by the FBI. And so I went downstairs first. I was to learn later that our phones had been jammed and we couldn't get anybody on the phone. So I went downstairs first. And when I opened the door, I was greeted by these targeting darts that were attached to automatic weapons in my chest. And there were several of them. And there was an armored vehicle in front of my house. And this voice was saying, come out, move forward toward me with your hands held high. And so I followed the command, and my wife on her way out following me, coming down the stairwell, she was greeted by a drone that almost hit her in the face going up the stairs to our home. And so when I got out, I was zip tied immediately. My wife was handcuffed behind her back. And I'm inquiring, what is going on? Why is this happening? And I'm told they have a search warrant that I never did see until, and I asked to see it, and they, rather conveniently or not, didn't have it in their immediate possession. So I didn't see the search warrant until hours later, when I was able to come back into my home and find the search warrant on the table there. In the meantime, in the South St. Louis, which is a predominantly white area of the city, that where we've established offices filled with the African People Solidarity Committee, which is an organization of white people who do mostly reparations work, but also basic solidarity work with the struggle for African liberation. Their office was being raided, and battering rams were used, the same kind of command about come out, that this is the FBI. They used flashbang grenades in the place. They stuck a video, they stuck tape on the video camera, so in an attempt to mask their activities, even though we were able to get some of that. And they went to the apartment upstairs. They held a young couple at gunpoint. These are two of the leaders in the solidarity movement at gunpoint. At the same time, they had gone to the home of two of the solidarity leaders, and they had banged, knocked their doors in and held them also at gunpoint, detained them at gunpoint. And the same time in St. Petersburg, Florida, where it was 6 o'clock Eastern time, they used battering rams, knocked the doors in at Uhuru House, our office there. And they took our radio station briefly off the air. They raided our archives and took some of the materials from there. And they went to the residence of another person who has been characterized as an unindicted co-conspirator, young woman. They went to her house, her resident, and they used the St. Petersburg police to tell her, knock on the door, tell her that a car was being broken into and she should come out and look at it. And when she went outside, the FBI came from around this van and what have you. And they used that as an excuse to get into her vehicle to take her cell phone. They took my cell phone. They took the phone from my wife. They took they stole computers. They stole iPads, and they did a similar thing to our office in St. Petersburg, Florida. They stole financial records for the various community development programs that we are responsible for in St. Louis and St. Petersburg and Philadelphia and Oakland, California, et cetera. They took all of that stuff. And so that was what happened on that day. I continued to ask them why this was happening. And they said that, I said, well, if you have a warrant, why am I handcuffed? And they said it's for your protection and ours. And they gave me the right to sit on the curb. And then when I refused to do that, they told me I can sit in the back of their car. And I wasn't interested in doing that either. They told me that I should, if I wanted to get my phones back quickly, I should open the phone so they could access it. And they said the same thing to my wife, who refused to open the phones. And continued to say, we don't want to be here. Can I leave? Can I leave? And so finally, he said, you can leave. So I started to walk away. And either one of us, me and my wife, said, well, what about our cars? We can take the car. So they were really nice in the sense that they said, well, where are your car keys? And they went upstairs to find the car keys where they were located, brought the car keys down. And so we were able to leave, but we had been unable to contact anybody, like I said, because our phones had been jammed. And so we were isolated like that. Before we left, they said that they had the search warrant because an indictment was going to be dropped later that morning of a Russian national, and that my name was in that indictment. And so that was what it was about. I was to learn that there was some allegation that that I was on the payroll of Russia, that the work that I've been doing now for 60 years or so and 50 years with the African People's Socialist Party, or if not the duration of it, recently, been paid by the Russians to do that. And that and it had to do with the elections that we had run two campaigns. Well, actually, about four, a total of four campaigns, two in 2017, two in 2019 in St. Petersburg, Florida. And they wanted to say that we were doing this at the behest of the Russians and possibly that we were paid by the Russians to do this, you know, et cetera. And that the Russians had paid us, I think, an allegation to do some other just ridiculous kind of thing. And it's absolutely and totally nonsensical, I mean, because like I'm saying that the African People's Socialist Party just celebrated our 50th anniversary in May of this year. We've been here for 50 years. I've been doing this work for nearly 60 years or so. And nobody's ever had to pay me to do this work. In fact, for most of my life or most of my activity, I haven't been paid anything. And it's only in a recent period, over the last several years, that I've even developed a capacity to receive some kind of compensation to stay alive while I've done this work. And so it's just a ridiculous characterization of what my political activity is about and what political activity of the Uhuru movement and the African People's Socialist Party is all about. So it's a ridiculous charge on the face of it.
And we're going to get into more about what the African People's Socialist Party is about, what the Uhuru movement is about. But before we do that, I have video that I used from Burning Spear Media, which is your media organization. Can we just, Brad, show some of that video? I want to make sure viewers get a sense of what it looked like for you all. And if you want to say anything about what's happening.
Yeah, this is St. Louis. This is after the raid. I'm out of the house now. This is broken glass in the rear stairwell of my home. And I initially didn't know it. They had entered broken glass, knocked the door in, used flashbang grenades in the stairwell and plaster all over the place. And this is this is a duplex. Part of it is right here that was empty at the time. But you can see some of the damage that was done, damage to windows, blinds down. There's a board that's up there covering the window. They had damaged doors there as well. And so that's part of it. And this is the armored vehicle, but you have no sense of the number of them that were out in front of this house at the time. And like I said, even when I was standing there talking to them, flashbang grenades were continuously exploding around the house and in that immediate vicinity.
These are the doors.
Yeah, this is the door. I'm not quite. Oh, yeah, this is looks like it's either the front door to my house or the door next to it, the duplex there, where you can see how the door's been knocked in. Again, the armored vehicle. This is St. Petersburg, Florida, the Uhuru house there. This is them at the front of the Uhuru house building in St. Petersburg, Florida. They breached the gate there. Now they're breaching the front door, the entrance door. This is some of the damage, and this is some of them.
Look how many there are.
I mean, it's hard to believe the number of forces they've put there.
Jesus.
This is the sort of the reception area, and this is where they were cameraing using tape. They used the St. Petersburg Police Department blocked off. In the background there, you can see the Uhuru house. These are financial drawers that they had gone through, taking our records and what have you from there.
There's a picture of you, right?
Yes.
That got knocked over, I guess.
Doing the same thing then that I'm doing now. And that was a long time ago.
another door broken down. Then this is them leaving your house.
This is the home I have in St. Petersburg. Nobody's there because, I mean, this is in Florida. So they raided the empty house in Florida. They took devices. This is the car of Achille Nai, who they tricked to come out so that they could take her cell phone from her. That's in St. Petersburg, Florida. And this is the Solidarity Reparations Center on the south side of St. Louis. This is them coming in.
To the Solidarity House?
Yeah, Solidarity Center, yes.
What is that white, that stuff that's like flying around?
It's debris coming from the flashbang grenades.
Jesus. What was running through your head when this was happening?
Well, when I came out of my house in St. Louis, what was running through my head was December 4th, 1969, when the FBI aided the Chicago Police Department in murdering Fred Hampton at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so, you know, when I walk out and my chest is covered with these targeting dots, you know, from automatic weapons, and I thought they were going to kill me right there. My wife thought they were going to kill me and us, you know, as well. So that was the first thing that went through my mind, that they were going to assassinate me. And, you know, there was no warning. There was no, hey, we, you know, we want to talk to you or anything like that. And it was hard to understand some aspects of what was going on, because it certainly, when they talked about they had a search warrant, obviously they didn't need armored vehicles and turning off our phones and flashbang grenades and all these things to serve a search warrant. So it was clear that whatever they were saying, it was not connected to what they were doing, that they were making an assault on us and they were using some very old law that they've used against people, you know, like W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, was charged with the very same thing. And so they've used this and other kinds of laws like that to break the back of our movement. I mean, so I knew that an objective of this was to crush the movement. I didn't know the specifics of what it was that they were up to at that moment.
And can you talk more about the W.E.B. Du Bois story?
Yeah, W.E.B. Du Bois, in 1951, he was charged with the very same thing, indicted for the very same thing, and actually went to trial. And he was acquitted on the trial. He traveled all over, you know, speaking out, similar to what I'm doing now, just in terms of speaking out about what's going on. So he was able to be acquitted, but they ruined him in terms of economics. They had taken his passport. They gave it back to him after he was acquitted, and he traveled to Ghana. But when he got to Ghana, they took his passport again, so he couldn't come back to the country. And Du Bois was, you know, whatever else he might be characterized, but, you know, we consider Du Bois a liberal of sorts, you know, and he played a really important role in the FBI attack on Marcus Garvey that had happened, you know, earlier in the century. And he played that really important role for that. And of course, the FBI, under the color of law, Garvey had done this incredible thing, built, you know, an organization from 6 to 11 million African people around the world, had created economic entities similar to what we are emulating right now, had actually purchased steamship lines so that Africans could trade with each other globally, had created ambassadors traveling around the world, had intervened at the League of Nations conference in 1919 when they were discussing what was going to be done with parts of Africa, making the declaration that Africa, for Africans at home and abroad. So they attacked Garvey, FBI, said that he defrauded, used the mail to defraud the people with selling stock for the steamship line that he had. So, you know, this is like been a sort of history that we've seen. And then Du Bois, they took Paul Robeson, as you know. It's really interesting about Robeson because he went to the United Nations with a petition the charge the United States with genocide against African people here. So they attacked him. They brought him before the House of Un-American Activities. And, you know, are you now, have you ever been, you know, like a member of the Communist Party of USA? They did a real serious attack on him. And that's just the history of it. I mean, you know, I'm mentioning these relatively well-known people, but the FBI, as you know, with this counterintelligence program that targeted what they call Black nationalist hate groups, the hounding of Martin Luther King that they did, that they tried to get King to commit suicide, what they did to Malcolm X and they declared in 1969 that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. So this is the history of that relationship. That's why I think it's really important for us not to accept, you know, the way this thing has been framed by the government and government media. It's a history there that's not addressed at all. And that's extremely problematic.
And so what did they go after Du Bois for, though? I'm still not clear.
They said that he was an agent of the Soviet Union.
Ah, okay.
Soviet Russia, if you will. So Russia is still like a factor there. Yeah.
And wanted to ask you about your own past a little bit. We'll get deeper into the politics and deeper into your organization. But I wanted to go back to 1966. At this point, you're the vice chairman of the Florida Front of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You're in St. Petersburg, and the City Hall of St. Petersburg has this mural that was made in 1945. Brad, can we show an image of this mural? So it's this mural that's a pretty offensive, racist, stereotypical scene with the big lips and the white paint on the lips. Tell us what you did to this mural in December of 1966.
Well, this was an 8-by-10-foot mural on the wall of that government building. And we complained about it. And the mayor told us that our minorities have to become less sensitive to, you know, this kind of stuff. And everybody knows I'm not a racist, et cetera, or something to that effect. And we couldn't get any relief. And so on one occasion, December 29th, I think it was, we had organized a march to the city hall to complain about that and about the economic exploitation of the community, how the city government was involved in getting $50 million from the federal government. They get this money and that's supposed to be helpful to the African community in terms of dealing with blight and things like that. And instead, they were going to use it to beautify downtown St. Petersburg. So we were complaining about that as well. And so we had this demonstration. And when we got to the city hall, people were standing on the steps, speaking out from the steps, complaining about the condition that African people were experiencing there. And a little old lady was talking, and she was laughed at by the reporters and by the police. And
she was a Black woman, right? The old lady was a Black woman?
Yeah, she was a Black woman. And, they didn't appreciate, you know, like her command of the English language, and they were laughing at her. And so the humiliation is just too much. This old woman and everything that she and Black women and people like her have had to endure. And all she wanted to do is she was just complaining of how Black people pay all of our money into these insurance companies, buying insurance, and then when something happens, somebody dies, they lose their money. That's what she was talking about, and the police and the reporters were laughing. So, you know, I turned and marched into the city hall, and this young brother, Jody Walls, who was only 17 at the time, he came with me. And I tore the mural down from the wall, and we began to march through the city of St. Petersburg with the mural. And this was like the first actually direct action of the Black Power movement that happened in this country. When I say first direct action, I mean, you have to remember that the Black Power movement itself was born out of the civil rights movement through the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And SNCC was well known for direct action. That was one of the things that characterized it. It was an organization primarily of young people, although Sister Ella Baker, who was the key to organizing, she was not as young. She wouldn't have been considered young. So we marched down the streets with it, and they arrested us. They arrested six of us all together and put us, locked us up. They charged me with 11 different offenses, one of which was a felony, at least one of which was a felony. And they convicted me on one or two misdemeanors and then charged me and tried me on a felony charge of grand larceny for the theft of the mural, and sentenced me to 5 years in prison. And so I did, about 2.5 years in and out on appeal bond on that particular charge. So that's what that was about. And then later, the Supreme Court would rule that double jeopardy would have occurred if what my lawyer had put forth as a description of events there, and they removed the sentence and then remanded the trial back, remanded the case back to the Pinellas County for them to make a decision of whether or not what was said to have occurred actually did occur in terms of the trial and it being double jeopardy. And the Pinellas County said, no, that's not what happened. So the court had resolved this issue that it wanted to resolve. I had been tried once for destruction of public property as a misdemeanor. Then they tried me for grand larceny, and it was grand larceny by destruction of the property. So this was a contradiction that the court needed resolving, and they used my case to resolve that so that it was grand larceny if that happened. And so they took it back to, remanded the case back to Florida, and they said, no, that's not what happened. So they had resolved that, got rid of the double jeopardy thing, still on the books today, dealing with that. And then they tried me again. And then this time they tried, convicted me, and sentenced me to 3 years in prison. So I was in and out of prison around that case until 1973. When finally, because we had developed a significant enough kind of movement and things were happening in various places around the country and the world, that it became perhaps a bit of an albatross around the neck. And so they decided that they would just sentence me to time served and forget about it. So that's how that happened. But I think that you know, really what's I think extremely important here, and this is one of the reasons I think that we really need an army, a battery of lawyers around this case, because it's clearly a political assault that's being made on me, on the African People's Socialist Party, Huda movement. And one of the things that I really want to pull attention to is, if you remember, it was in 1965 that the Voting Rights Act was passed in this country. And it was in 1964 that I became, you know, extremely involved in voting rights issues and questions in the state of Florida. By 1960, in fact, I ran somebody's campaign in 1964. The people were being killed just for trying to vote in this country. Black people were. You know, churches bombed, children killed, assassinations were occurring, that kind of thing. In 1965, 66, I was doing voter registration work throughout Florida. In fact, some irony is in the fact that I had about six counties in North Florida in a program that was actually sponsored by Vernon Jordan, who had been a leader of the core Congress of Racial Equality, and then who became a pals with the Clintons and did something with that blue dress of Monica Lewinsky. So I was Northern Florida, had about six counties. And I worked, I was in Madison, Florida, where a mob of white people tried to murder me just for trying to register black people to vote. I was in Florida, in Alachua County, Florida, where the county sheriff wanted to arrest me and frighten off people I was taking to register to vote. So I've been involved like with this and the Voting Rights Act, again, 1965, which was supposed to be allowing African people the right to vote. But it wasn't just like that. I mean, we were running into terror all around, you know, the country, and particularly in the South, trying to do that. So then we see, even in 1963, if you remember, with the March on Washington in 1963, where they actually forced the one they love to love today to change his speech. He was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the time. He is the one about Good Trouble. What's the fellow's name? You know what I'm talking about. Good Trouble and John Lewis. You know, he was forced to change his speech at that March on Washington because he had asked a question of the United States government, which side are you on? That was in the speech. And he had to change that speech. He couldn't make that speech. He couldn't include that in the speech. So the voting rights thing was supported by the liberals and what have you. But the voting meant that we could get the right to vote, but the political line that we took, you know, could not be one that challenged the U.S. You got to remember at the time, the U.S. was engaged in a huge struggle, not only inside the United States, but it was being judged by peoples of the world in terms of the system of the murder, brutality of African people. And it was in this contest with Soviet Russia in particular, and to a lesser extent with China, about which was the preferable system. And so to have the United States government doing these kinds of things made it really important for them to achieve some kind of resolution about the right black people to vote. Otherwise, the hypocrisy of the democracy that's being talked about was going to be hard to conceal. So that was in the 1960s. I was involved in that struggle and very serious. I registered people to vote. I organized throughout the state of Florida for the right for people to vote. Later on, by 1972, I ran for office myself in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I wasn't running as a serious candidate, but I ran because the United States government was still trying to put me in prison because of the Mueller charge from then. And so I wanted to give them, you know, a situation where they have to arrest me as a candidate, you know, for office. But I did run for office. We did engage in electoral politics. We ran other people for office on a regular basis. We did that within the electoral process. But the thing I wanted to point out is that historically, the right to for African people to vote and participate in an election has been something that's been under assault by private citizens, by states, governors and militia, by county sheriffs and what have you. And now what we have is a situation since 2017, the Black Hispanic Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations that I organized has been teaching in communities how to participate in electoral politics, and along with how to participate, the techniques, how to run for office, how to put things on the ballot, how to do recalls and do all these other things, and include what will be on the ballot, the issue of reparations. There are certain places you can pass initiatives, put initiatives on the ballot. We do that. We'd run elections in 1980s, you know, around land reform and things like that in Oakland, California. So this is the electoral process that we are using. And what we're looking at now is that the FBI attacks us, and they use the reason for attacking us. Part of it is somehow it's the Russians who are paying us to run for office. And it just seems to me I can't make a distinction except for the severity of the explosion in what happened in Birmingham when they murdered those little children with the bomb because Black people wanted to vote. And what they were doing all around this country, with the fact that right now, as we have this discussion, there are more than 400 pieces of legislature circulating throughout this country to minimize the right of Black people to vote. And then in 18 states, this has already occurred. And now the FBI attacks us around voting. And they're not saying that they're attacking us around voting because of segregation today and segregation tomorrow and segregation forever, like George Wallace. They're not saying that. They're using some other spurious claim to attack that. And it seems to me, if nothing else, this is where you're talking about a battery of lawyers. And it seems to me, if nothing else, the FBI is violating the Voting Rights Act of 1965, just like they did when they bombed the church in Birmingham, just like they have, well, that was before 65, but just like they have done subsequent to prevent Black people from being able to vote. And so this was an attack on and when we talk about the elections in 2017 in St. Petersburg, Florida, what was our campaign around? Reparations. It was around gentrification of Black communities and things like that. And we did a similar thing in 2019. And then we've done the same kind of campaign here in St. Louis. We ran for 5 years in a row. We've been able teaching people who are not part of the political establishment to participate in elections running on some of these same principles. And then we get attacked by the FBI with the claim that it's not we, you know, we don't know what it is that we want. The Russians are paying us to do this. And just like we were outside agitators, and I've been an outside agitator before, anytime somebody comes in and organizes among our people, it's not what we want, it's some other external force that they can, you know, point a finger to. So I just wanted to point that out, Katie.
Yeah, I mean, Susan, we heard Susan Rice say something like that about Black Lives Matter, George Floyd protests. She suggested it could have been the Russians. We heard Kamala Harris say that Colin Kaepernick taking a knee was the Russians. So that is alive and well, and people actually say it out loud.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because Kamala Harris, if I'm not mistaken, was one of those Negro politicians who was influenced by our 2017 program elections calling for reparations. Because she and a couple of others then had to raise the reparation issue because it had become such a significant and popular issue on the agenda now. So, all of them, it's always the Russians or somebody else, but not us. We are not smart enough to. I don't know if you've seen it, but Macron is having, that is Emmanuel Macron in France, is having a very difficult time because he, some less than 2 weeks after what happened to us, he was in Cameroon, and France controls something like 14 different entities that they call countries, absolutely, and stealing all the resources there historically. So masses of Black people have been turning against France and telling France to get the hell out of Africa. So Macron was in this huge mass meeting. I think it was in Cameroon. And he was telling the people that it's the Russians who are telling you this, that it's Russia that's responsible for the attitude that you have. It's Russian social media, it's Russian agents and things like that. And you can Google that, by the way. That's and you should have seen the outrage from the mass of the people who were in that meeting. We don't need Russians to tell us what France has done to us all this time. And that's a fundamental contradiction, you know, that's out there. So we're not smart enough to know that we afflicted by colonial terror and oppression. And even to utilize the electoral process, they will even shut that down. Say you can't use the electoral process if you're doing it and you're raising issues that's important to Black people, then it must be the Russians or somebody else. What happened to the presumption of free speech after the Emancipation Proclamation and certainly after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1966? What happened to any of that stuff? You know, it's out of the window and they assumed to be able to get away with it because just like segregation was legal in the South up until passage of these various kinds of laws, now this whole notion that they can use the law to justify oppression and even to say Black people cannot participate even in the electoral process on our own terms. We can't say anything about Africa. We can't say anything about reparations. We can't say anything about genocide. We can't say anything about what's happened to us as a people. We have to toe the line. And if we toe the line, it's all right. And so anyway, that's part of what occurred. Uhuru.
There's an image Brad just put in, which is from 1933 Alabama, which speaks to what you're talking about. So this is a poster that says, "Negroes beware, do not attend communist meetings. Paid organizers for the communists are only trying to get Negroes in trouble. Alabama is a good place for good Negroes to live in, but is a bad place for Negroes who believe in social equality. The Ku Klux Klan is watching you. Take heed. Tell the communist leaders to leave. Report all communist meetings to the Ku Klux Klan."
So they're saying that there is this secret organization that's watching you. That was in the 30s. The secret organization called itself the Klan. "We're watching you. And if anybody says anything to you, report it to the Klan." And this is more or less the same message that we're seeing now. There's somebody watching you. And if you don't say the right things today, Negroes, this is what can be an outcome. They'll come at 5 o'clock in the morning if it's not 4, like it was when they killed Fred Hampton.
And so where are you now? I don't know how much you can reveal about the case, but where are you now in your legal trouble?
Well, the struggle is continue to be struggling around this question of lawyers. It really is a kind of serious issue. I mean, we're talking to, I think you may have been helpful in at least having a lawyer that we can talk to. So we're involved in that. And we have had a meeting. I don't know if you were in that meeting we had last Saturday. There were about 150 people from various places around the United States and the world who indicated they want to participate in this. And we're not treating it like some kind of typical defense thing, because we think that we have to fight back. So we actually call it sort of a counteroffensive that we engaged in. So we have to raise a lot of money, because the lawyers are going to cost a lot of money. And we're looking at two different states where we're having like to fight from. And also, again, we're not going to be helped by only responding to what their narrative is. We're going to have to be able to fight back and to initiate our own counteroffensive, even in the legal system. So they need to be able to explain how they can be attacking Black people around the right to vote under whatever color they want to use it with, you know, for that. That's what they did. When they came and bombed my house and stole our devices and what have you, now I'm hearing that the reason they're doing that is because somebody told us to run for office and paid us to run for office. And that's the same kind of stuff that 1933, 1950s garbage that was spewed when people named themselves for whom they were. And they say, "This is the Klan. We are some white nationalist organization that's telling Black people you can't vote. If you vote, this is what will happen to you." And that's exactly what they're saying now. And there's enough sentiment in this country among sectors of the population. I mean, think about this. Even if they tell this ridiculous story about us, nobody is commenting. They're not commenting on the fact that not only did mobs of white people attack the Capitol to try to overthrow the government and chase the vice president through the halls talking about hanging him. They're not even talking about that. But they're not even talking about the fact that there are more than 400 pieces of legislation that's circulating in state capitals throughout this country that's designed to minimize the ability of African people to participate in the elections, and that 18 of those states, including the state of Florida, have already passed legislation minimizing the ability of Black people to vote. That's not even on the agenda. Somehow, you raise up this question, Black people who only recently achieved what's supposed to be the right to vote in this country, we are the ones. We Black people died, you know, to go to register to join the Joe Biden's Democratic Party. Black people's churches were bombed to join Joe Biden's Democratic Party. And now his administration is committing the same kinds of offenses that's been committed against us since George Wallace and every other reactionary in this country. And he's saying that, okay, you can vote,
but you can only vote and put on the agenda what we want you to talk about. If you do something other than that, because the Russians or some other external force told you to do it. And they can use that as the basis of torture, murder, mayhem, stealing your resources, bombing your houses, threatening yourself and your wife and family. This is what you can do. This is what is being pursued right now in broad daylight. People see this, and people in this country are not stupid. They know the history that Black people have with America. And to say that, okay, suddenly I believe that all of the time these suffering, oppressed Black people whose labor went to this developing the entire economy of this country on stolen Indian land, that somehow they are the problem. People know better than that. And the country is split in 1,000 different ways, and we didn't do it. We didn't do January 6th. The African People's Socialist Party and Omali Ishatella did not do January 6th. We did not attack the Capitol. We did not chase that white man through the Capitol saying, hang the vice president. We didn't do that. And we didn't put our feet up and on Nancy Pelosi's desk before she went on this provocative tour to China. We didn't defecate in the offices of the congresspersons. We didn't do that. And yet somehow, suddenly Black people who've done all this suffering and fighting just for the right to vote, somehow we are the threat to the electoral process, just like the Black Panther Party was defined as the greatest threat to internal security of the United States. What kind of security is it? Well, you've got, you know, they've sent at least easily counted for $60 billion to Ukraine alone. You got this huge military apparatus and what have you, and you're deploying it on Redbud Avenue in St. Louis, Missouri, to the most oppressed sector of the population and perhaps one of the most deep economically depressed places in the country. It doesn't make any sense. It says, you know, what we have to do that's so really very much important is help the people to focus on the reality. You can't understand a process by just looking at where it is at this moment. You got to investigate the history of that process. How did it get this? Why is it all of a sudden that people are attacking Black people for the right to vote? Is it sudden? Is this really, you know, incredible that the FBI would do this when every other entity in this country since electoral politics became something that was possibly on the agenda has moved to attack Black people's right to vote? And then what's different from the FBI has done? What's different from the deal that Republicans and the Democrats made in 1876 and 77 that with this so-called compromise that took the troops in the South, out of the South that was supposed to be able to protect Black people. And that lasted for almost 100 years until 1966 with the Civil Rights passage of the Civil Rights Bill, 65 with the passage of the Voting Rights, when the FBI was supposed to be there helping us have the right to vote. And now my house is being bombed because they say I'm not voting right, or somehow what George Wallace said was right, what Stennis in Mississippi said was right, that it's some kind of outsiders who are responsible for Black people wanting to vote. This is the same line. There's no fundamental difference.
Are you afraid to talk about, well, you're not afraid, obviously, but I've been disturbed by how, if you say anything, you just mentioned the funding for Ukraine. If you say anything at all questioning the support of a proxy war, you're then a Putinist, a shill for Putin. I wonder if another byproduct that people would like to see is to shut people up with attacks on you.
It is. It's part of that, I'm sure. But and lawyers are concerned about that, even though we haven't consolidated lawyers. They're telling me about talking, you know, because what the government is doing is making a political attack, and they are organizing around this legal narrative so that anything I say, not anything I say now, anything I've said over the last several years, anything of the texts and emails and videos and things like that they have from me is something that they would use to create a narrative that would support these charges, these bogus charges that they. So that's real serious. I mean, and it places me in a very precarious kind of situation. The question I'm confronted with is whether I shut up and not say anything about it, not fight back, not respond to it. Because if I do that, then it's like having been assassinated or having been imprisoned because I assassinated and imprisoned myself. So the right to be able to talk about Black people and the oppression of my people has been taken away from me because I've agreed to cooperate to that level. So it's a very tenuous kind of situation. And for me, a fundamental question is all these people who proclaim a belief in First Amendment rights, belief in civil rights, et cetera, and especially lawyers, we need you. Because what is happening now is what they were able to successfully do at certain times in the history of the struggle in this country. They want to deny us the right to access to the a full democratic process here. So they would drive people on the ground and force people into precipitous actions like armed struggles and stuff like that. I'm telling that we need people to step forward. We need lawyers. And we don't have a lot of money. Our money goes to these programs that we've created for our community. We need people to make contributions. We need people to provide legal assistance here so that we can wage this struggle. Because it ain't my struggle. It really isn't. It's for everybody who proclaims to believe or believe in what this country says is supposed to be about. And it seems to me that's where a lot of the responsibility is.
Well, we are going to bring in another speaker, Alex Vitale, who is a sociologist. He is professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and a visiting professor at London South Bank University. And he's the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics and the End of Policing. So, Alex, welcome.
Thanks, Katie. Nice to be here.
Of course. I thought it would be an interesting conversation to have both of you talk a little bit about the role of the FBI and the police and the potential abolition of both entities or either entity. You, of course, wrote a book, The End of Policing. What does that even mean, abolition, in this context?
Right. So, you know, abolition doesn't mean that there's some magical switch somewhere that if we just wanted to, we could just turn off all police and then figure out what comes next, right? This is about a long-range, long-term process of social transformation. And it begins by campaigns that are designed to reduce the power and authority of law enforcement and replace it with better alternatives. So we've seen over the last few years, obviously, a huge amount of mobilization around this issue in terms of local policing, but we could also apply this to federal policing. I wrote a piece of, a few years ago for The Nation about abolishing the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's basically, they don't serve any positive social function. They're not saving any lives. They're not preventing anyone from experiencing harm. They're enforcing drug prohibition in a way that's deeply harmful, and that agency should just be eliminated. And similarly, we should look at the functions of the FBI. So in a piece that I wrote for Truth Out the other day, after Marjorie Taylor Greene said, defund the FBI, somehow I don't think this is what was bothering her that caused her to want to say that. Let's look at what the FBI really does. Political policing, these kinds of trumped up war on terror investigations, enforcing the Patriot Act, but also they play a major role in enforcing the war on drugs, in enforcing a war on sex workers, enforcing a war on young people accused of being in gangs, being involved in violence. And all of this is not only ineffective, but actually counterproductive. And so instead of falling into this liberal trap of, well, they're going after Trump, so, we need them. We need to instead be pointing out, the deep history of harm at the center of the FBI and the fact that we don't need them to produce public safety.
I remember, Alex, you said to me once, abolition is like what you see on the Upper East Side in New York City. So if you're in a private school and you do drugs, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to say, what did you do? Now let's go talk to the school therapist. Okay, now we're going to bring in your parents. Okay, now we're going to go to a rehab center. There's so many steps that happen before the police are involved. And I think that one of the things that the Uhuru movement is doing, the African People's Socialist Party does, it is an abolitionist organization in that it creates a lot of alternatives for youth to engage in a way that I think probably prevents a lot of criminalization of young people.
Yeah, I think I think if you look at some of the programs that they're running in St. Louis is a city with a lot of abolitionist organizing, the Close the Work campaign and a whole program around alternatives to policing that has a lot of community support there. What's going on there is, you know, it's in the spirit of the Black Panther Party, and the delivery of direct services to the community is a way of building community cohesion, community power, and saying we don't need coercive, negative state interventions, the police, to produce safe, healthy communities. We can do that ourselves if you will just give us the space to do this and possibly some resources. But I think most importantly, you know, quit undermining the community, and the community will take positive steps on its own.
One of the things that we saw recently is this terrible attack on a man in Arkansas who is just being pummeled by the police. One of the things that you talk about in The End of Policing is how things like that are not a bug, they're the system.
Right. Yeah, this is not some aberration, right? That these kinds of beatings occur on a regular basis. We don't know all the details in this case, and we don't see on the video what happened just prior to the incident. But I think what we're dealing with here is a situation of contempt of cop or some kind of resistance to police authority. And that is dealt with through violence, quite typically. And look, we just need to look at what happened to Eric Garner, what happened to George Floyd. This could just as easily have turned into an outcome like that. Thankfully, it did not. But when police are confronted with resistance, they will escalate. No matter how much de-escalation training they have had, they're not going to allow someone to win a confrontation like that with them. And so one of the things we have to ask ourselves in this question is, you know, why is this even a police matter? Now, of course, after they beat him up, they charge him with all these outrageous charges, which is typical when they beat someone up for contempt of cop. But really, he was, you know, he was maybe menacing someone in a fast food grocery gas station type situation, which is not great. But I think that there's some indications that what we're dealing with here is basically a mental health problem that I'm sure has been untreated. And that instead of sending someone who could try to help deal with this person from a clinical perspective, we send armed police who immediately overreact and escalate the situation.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at weightwatchers.com.